Those represent the first words of Romans 3:25. And we are bringing to a close that longest sentence that Paul ever uttered from the 21st verse until the 26th, culminating in this phrase, whom the previous verse ending in Jesus Christ, whom he set before himself. Who set him before? The God as a he last tier eon. Quickly, because the message is on the resurrection. How convenient we come to this point in the 240th message. What does that helasterion mean for the sake of those that haven't been here in the previous weeks? Bear with me, folks. You already could answer that question. In the tabernacle, in the wilderness, on the great day of atonement, we have a study in types. In the outer court, sacrifice for sin occurred. Propitiation. God had said, for sin comes death. His integrity is latched onto that. The devil said, you won't die. And that's been the struggle God has had. His integrity put a fence around him and walled him inside that capsule of integrity and faithfulness to his word. A prisoner of honesty whose nature is to love. And before he could let Adam and Eve stand before him in that record in the garden, he slew an animal, first time they ever saw death, and covered them with the skins of the animal. James Boyce has preached a wonderful message, the famous Presbyterian preacher, entitled, Fig Leaves or Skin? The covering of their own making and their own doing and their own effort would not let them stand before God. And early on, God expressed his intention to provide a vicarious substitute that would die in their place. And early on and through the centuries, the doubts expressed in the New Testament regarding propitiation or adequate payment are uttered in the words, not the blood of animals and goats, but one worth more than all of us, had to be presented. But temporarily, the sacrifice of another and the shedding of blood, the outpouring of the life of the flesh, gave access to God, and in the ancient Hebrew word, gave kaforet, covering. That's the name applied not to the altar outside, not where payment of sin and the display of God's anger and wrath towards sin that had separated him from the child of his love. On the Day of Atonement, sacrifice out here, the type of the world, the outer court. But the major, most important act was not propitiation out here, rather at the propitiatory, the place where the adequacy of the sacrifice, the adequacy of the payment, the adequacy of propitiation, the adequacy of expiation was testified to by the one above all, God Himself. And in this inner tent was the holy place with the candlestick, the altar of incense, the table of showbread, and in the Holy of Holies, the Ark of the Covenant containing the tablets of stone, unbroken in that type of the Messiah. Acacia wood, root out of a dry ground, identity with us, and solid gold, the constant type of the Holy Spirit and divine nature. And over this, shielding God's standard of holiness, the works of the law, the kapharoth, the covering, atonement, that which makes at-one-ment, that kapharoth. The high priest was not finished until he took the blood containing the life of the sacrifice into the type of heaven and sprinkled the blood on the Holy of Holies, Ark of the Covenant, covering the standard of God's righteousness, which if the type is personified, God looking out looks through the covering, and thus his righteousness being met by the price of the sacrifice, he can embrace and pour forth in love. The Greek Septuagint translates that kapharoth with hilasterion. Twice in the New Testament, the word is used. Here in Hebrews 9, Romans 3, 25, and Hebrews 9. Hebrews is attempting to explain the better way. And the ninth chapter opens saying, they had a tabernacle. I've just diagrammed it. And in their tabernacle was furniture, all of which were types of God's redemptive plan. And it names the furniture, one after another. Then it comes to the Holy of Holies, the type of the heavenly act, the propitiatory, where testimony of the adequacy of the sacrifice is made, sprinkles the blood on the kapharoth. And under their law, if the sacrifice were not adequate, the priest is struck dead at that moment. What joy when he comes out on the Day of Atonement. That means God accepted the sacrifice, and all their sins, in that case, only for the previous year, were covered. Propitiatory testifies adequate sacrifice. This is the type of the world. This is the heavenlies. And not until the blood was sprinkled did he come out as the high priest, obviously not dead, sacrifice accepted, and then lay his hands on what the Old Testament calls Azazel's lot. Two goats, cast lots over them. One, the Lord's lot, was sacrificed. Two, Azazel's lot. Erroneously, and it creeps into all or most all of the New Testament versions of the English language, both Luther and Tyndale chose the word scapegoat. No, the scapegoat was not blamed for the sins. The sins were laid by the laying of hands. God lets them transfer their sins to the head of the goat. The Lord's lot was slain. This goat is not slain. It's led to Azazel, which identified what they believed was the demonic prince of the devil in the desert. And I said, I can't really, particularly now, use the words I'd like to say, but eat bleep, Azazel. Here they come. This is what you've accused all through the year. God, you said, for sin comes death. You accuse them. They deserve death. I paid for them now. The sacrifice is accepted. Here, Azazel's goat, take him to him. Let him chew on them. They're useless to him anymore. No more accusation will stand. All of that typified what God is now saying in Romans 3:25, Jesus became the kapareth, the covering atonement. Jesus became the hilasterion. And after the death, so much interest this season on the death, the Passion movie, the resurrection made sense of the death. Without the resurrection, there's no hilasterion, because the hilasterion typifies an activity now in heaven from the minute of his raising, when he said to the woman, "Don't touch me, I haven't yet ascended to my Father." The unfinished work, the cross, propitiation is made in the outer court, the world, in the heavens. After the resurrected, immortalized body carries, if you will, his own blood and is set, as this verse says, before God as a hilasterion. And that's why this word twice used, Hebrews 9 and here, is the root for our word hilarity, hilarious, hilariousness, joy. Joy must have permeated heaven. God, prisoned by his own integrity, transcending it and offering in himself to bear through his Son the cross of propitiation, raised. And the courts of heaven flew open as the veil was rent that day from top to bottom. He's now free without compromising his integrity to joyously come to us. He made joy in heaven too. I have coined the phrase that Abraham got in, David got in, Abel got in. Their faith got them in. God took them for their faith. Though the last verse of the 11th chapter says they hadn't yet obtained the promise. This is the promise. He let them come to their faith. But there was still the accuser, still the question. You got a right to do what you want, God. But you said, for sin comes death, and yes, you bring them in because they trust you. But they come with a stain. They're heavenly green card members. They don't get their citizenship. But God, as he says at the close of this 25th and end of the 26th verse, proves he was righteous to forgive them even though their sin stained them, because he knew that the price would be paid and it would vindicate his forgiveness, and now they have full citizenship. We've been preaching that for weeks now. And on Easter, which has arrived, I'm able to show there's no hilasterion without the resurrection. You know, Orthodox branches of Jewry today still recognize the twofold picture of the Messiah, the suffering servant and the conquering king. They miss Jesus' first coming because they neglected the study of Isaiah and the identity of the suffering servant with the Messiah. They thought under their theology he suffered because of his sins. But even today, there are those in Jewry expecting two messiahs, one who will be killed by Antichrist in the tribulation or in the great war of Armageddon, and one that will win the war and set up his kingdom. They miss the fact he was that first phase of messiahship in his earthly identity with us And he will come again in the clouds of glory. Jewry has had it sort of rubbed in their face because the greatest manuscript of the Dead Sea Scrolls is the Isaiah Scroll. They dig down to Solomon's temple and find the large stones, and on the corner of one of them, a passage from Isaiah. And Jewry also recognized, particularly in that century, that there was not enough being done on the Day of Atonement when the temple in those days looked like a slaughterhouse as they brought the sheep in to be sacrificed on the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. Where do you think that word comes from? Covering, Kippur. Kaparet, the covering. Kippur, to cover. Yom Kippur, the day of covering. They recognized that there wasn't enough in these animal sacrifices on earth in the outer court of the temple. There had to be a heavenly work. Up, I think on the third floor, is a rare copy of a Dead Sea Scroll recently opened up to the world in translation. The Song of Sabbath, Psalms rather, of Sabbath Sacrifices, in which 13 heavenly princes, angels, perform a service in the heavens every Sabbath. Through 13 Sabbaths, a different angelic prince was typified as they would sing in the temple the Song of Sabbath Sacrifice, and 13 separate heavenly princes, they were but acting it out down here with the belief that 13 heavenly princes were performing an additional work in the heavens to solidify and cement the work on earth at Yom Kippur of the sacrifices of animals, anticipating what the resurrection made possible when even those 13 princes, though the Song of Sabbath Sacrifice doesn't go that far, they just recognize the need of something in the heavenlies. The Hilasterion, Jesus raised from the dead, set before God as the Hilasterion. And through those that have faith in the worth of his sacrifice, he looks at us through the spectacles. We've been on this for weeks. The Arabic, whom displaying oddly, Pekadama, whom Allah displayed, Vajah Allah, then made him to be Mogtafaran, Tafari, the verb to forgive, Morg in front of it, the place, Mogtafaran, the place of forgiveness, the Hilasterion, the Kaporeth. Only after the blood was brought in here was the scapegoat, so-called, sent away. The Hilasterion requires the resurrected one demonstrating to the heavens and declared to the earth no more compromise of his integrity. Price paid, barrier removed. God's Spirit can now come and help us become what God wants. Why do I believe in the resurrection? I went into college. They called it naturalism in those days, and scientism today. Anything supernatural? Anybody with intelligence knows if you can't have a natural explanation, it doesn't exist. My faith was destroyed temporarily. And to get my academic wings, I had to believe what they offered in the place of a supernatural Jesus. Something as mind-boggling as a heaven that exists and one who paid the price for our sins and was raised as the first fruits of what we can hope for, and set in front of God as the ever-present reminder when he looks at Gene Scott, price paid. Sins gone. Payment adequate. Amen to his blood, which contained his life, poured out in the outer court, resurrected to become the Hilasterion. You don't believe that. Get your academic wings with respectability. So this is the way I could get their smile. Jesus is a good and wise teacher. Good, wise. Sorry, not allowable. Took me a while to know that. That people normally, if they're intelligent, will not speak on a subject they haven't studied. Just because you're a lawyer, expert in family law, doesn't make you an expert in constitutional law. In fact, most judges in family court, I sometimes wonder if they've read the Constitution. You know, there have been some lawyers, some good lawyers. I've met a few. We have at least one here today. You know, when I started my search for faith, I had to wonder. There was only available Morrison, Frank Morrison, who moved the stone. A lawyer who set out to disprove the resurrection ended up writing one of the most convincing proofs. There was Sherlock's Trial of the Witnesses. Capstone Books has recently, because of my teaching, printed this out-of-date historic book. And they have it available. But now, after this will be message number 29 or 30, 29, I guess, on the resurrection, here's a lawyer, William Chandler, who does the trial of Jesus in the form of briefs, record of fact, Hebrew criminal law, the brief itself, that he presents the number of regular trials because it was before the Hebrew priest and then both before Pilate and before Herod, who was in charge of Galilee. And the minute Pilate found out he was from Galilee, a powerful defense by an attorney, William M. Chandler, and Pamela Bennings Ewan, a Baker and Botts, an international law firm in Houston, Texas, in Southeast Texas. She writes, this is commended by James Baker III, former Secretary of State. I don't know if that makes him an expert in anything except whatever law he's in. But this is one of the most fabulous of recent books. But all I had were those two. And I remember struggling at Stanford with my faith, and all of a sudden, Canon Brian Green, who subsequently ordained me in the basement of the Episcopal Church Cathedral in Melbourne, Australia. I'm looking for a quote. I found it right here. There was only two or three sources you could really go to. And he came along and introduced why Jesus cannot be called good and wise. And he gave a few illustrations, and I've spent the rest of my life finding others. And then he promised that if the claim Jesus made about himself were true, we have the most important event of history. And that which would vindicate them was his one claim that if he died, he would raise again in 3 days. And the next night he was going to teach on the resurrection and give the evidence of that. Man, I came eager, even invited my mother to go with me that night at Stanford, sitting up in the balcony. And he got up and said, I feel in my spirit to change in his unique British accent. He was the equivalent of the Anglican Church as Billy Graham. I feel in my spirit to address another subject tonight, the subject of sex. I told him later I hated him that night. He never said a word about the resurrection. And that put me on a 3.5-year course and a lifetime course to study the resurrection. But the critical thing I want to record, I've said it many times, but let me read some experts. C.S. Lewis. I am trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing. One of the greatest religious philosophers ever to live, C.S. Lewis. The marvelous movie been made about him, Shadowlands. Probably can pick it up somewhere, marvelous movie. I have a second reason for loving him. They got a stained glass window down here in Orange County with C.S. Lewis on it at a church smoking a pipe. That makes me like him even more. Just because all the fundamentalist preachers that are forever criticizing me and then plagiarizing C.S. Lewis, I'd like to take them down and rub their face on that stained glass window. And I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about Jesus. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That's the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level with a man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman, or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. That's out of Jesus Under Fire, one of the most powerful arguments against the Jesus Seminar in print. There are books debating the issue. Lots of stuff available today. But you can't get it in an hour to an hour and a half. And that's what we try to do every Easter. I was gullible enough to believe that the integrity of my professors, that wouldn't speak on a subject they hadn't studied, applied to their religious pronouncements. It didn't. And it took me a while to figure out, because I had enough background growing up in the church, that the Jesus they offered for me in the place of the one that I had didn't exist. I don't care what source you find, doesn't matter. The Jesus Seminar has come up with some lunatic cross gospel. They take a Coptic gospel of Thomas and want to give it more credence, discovered at Nag Hammadi. And the Coptic, which puts it into the second or third century, and they want to project it back to 70 A.D. and give it more credence than the Gospels. I don't care. They're wrong, but even taking their position in arguendo, back here, one of the exhibits is the Gospel of Thomas, and I have yellow line marker the statements in that Gospel of Thomas that no merely human, good, and wise teacher can be allowed to make. I don't care if you go again to Crossan's Cross Gospel, so-called, taken out of apocryphal works of Peter. Any source. Paul to the Corinthians says, I delivered unto you first of all that which I also received. And all scholars recognize there was that passion story, the most indelible thing that they had to tell, the death and resurrection. Circulating. Paul wrote that letter in 52 A.D. The critics of the gospel try to say, second, third century pseudo-epigrams, liars tacking the name of apostles on what they wrote to gain credence. Modern scholarship every year blows them out of the saddle. Down in the hall of the papyri, you will find copies posted of the Magdalene fragments. Study of writing is a recent science. The way letters are formed, date, strata, and it changes about every generation. Push back to 70 A.D. Also on the Hall of the Papyri with a large bulletin on it, a section of Mark's Gospel from Cave 7 of the Qumran Caves. Tealy has destroyed the opponents that want to say it's an Enoch. It doesn't fit, sorry. Mark thus is pushed before 68 A.D. because those caves were sealed when Jerusalem fell. An absolute benchmark that pushes it back to before 68 A.D., circulated sufficient that those of the Qumran caves would, as I do, want to read what the opponents of their view are saying. In addition to the Magdalene fragments, which we probably this time next year will have copies of, they're from the same scriptorium, the Barcelona fragments, and P4 in Paris, a fragment of Luke, all of them pushed before AD 70. I won't waste time today dealing with ignoramuses that have not kept themselves up to date. These were eyewitness reports. I have off the room of the book, Simonides, contested for years, finally recognized for what it is. Matthew dictating to Nicholas the deacon 15 years in the colophon after the death of Christ. So don't talk to me about these being written by second century fakes, because if they were, my final point will still be true. They were liars then. They made it up. You can't call Jesus good and wise. Don't care what source you find. Go ahead and define it. If you're going to call him good and wise, why? Deeds that he did, things that he said. Well, okay, where can I read what he said and what he's done? Give me your source. You pick it. Unless you wrote it in some drunken stupor. If it's any recognized by anybody as a valid historic source, you're going to find he says one of these things, one or more. Or he speaks, Jesus, I'll just put that caption on it, thought he was perfect. I'm not saying he was. I'm saying he thought he was. It reeks out of the sources that display him. He forgives sin. Judge not that you be not judged. You know, he qualmed. That's what got the Jewish leaders mad at him. Only God can forgive sin. Prophets would say, the Lord forgive you. He says, thy sins be forgiven. Neither do I condemn thee. Go and sin no more. He thought he was perfect. He judges with immunity. You Pharisees, the type and symbol of everything righteous, you're like painted over sepulchres, white on the outside, full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness, straining out a gnat and swallowing a camel. He's no good. Some have said, well, he said to the man who came to him and called him good master, why callest thou me good? He said, good rabbi. He wanted the recognition. If you're going to call me good, let it go beyond rabbi, because only God can be good. He said, think not that I'm come to destroy the law. I'm come to fulfill it. After condemning everybody else by saying, it's not the outward deed. The law says thou shalt not kill, but I say. Didn't say the Lord says. Behold, I say. If you hate in your heart, you're guilty of the deed. As he changed years of rabbinical teaching. He thought he was perfect. He felt no inadequacy of any kind And his prayer, the Lord's prayer, is not his prayer. He never prayed it. That's proof that he thought he was perfect. Never once. Every other religious leader prayed the prayers they taught their disciples. They led the prayers, they led the disciples in the prayers they taught them. Jesus said, they said, teach us to pray. He said, when ye pray, say this, including, forgive us our trespasses. He never uttered that prayer. His prayer is in John 17. Father, I did what you wanted me to do. I've done everything. Now restore me to the glory I had before I got here. No, even an implication of self-conscious moral inadequacy. We don't make saints of people who think they're perfect. Carlyle has said, the greatest of all sins, to be conscious of none. You don't see that in other founders of religion. Muhammad never thought he was perfect. Buddha never thought he was perfect. Confucius sure didn't. Muhammad saw visions. Buddha pursued what became the Eightfold Path of Buddhism because of Tanya. But we translate with the word thirst, but it's inadequate. This sense of identity and never-ending thirst for the things of time. He sought deliverance from his sense of moral inadequacy. Jesus ceded authority in himself. Every other religious leader dignified his pronouncements by an objective, separate criteria of authority. The prophet said, the Lord says. They claim vision or revelation. Gautama Buddha says, my death means nothing. I'm not even necessary to the way. All I leave you is the way, the Eightfold Path that worked for me. Try it, it'll work for you. Muhammad didn't see the authority in himself. He got revelations in the cave. Opponents say jinns, demons. Followers say angels. He never put it in himself. He seated it outside himself. Confucius made a logical analysis of society. He said, try it, it'll work. They tried it in one city, didn't work. Said, you tried it wrong. None of these people seated authority in themselves. Jesus, behold, you've heard it said unto you, but behold, I say, build on what I say, you build on a rock. Build on anything else, you build on a sand. All authority in heaven and earth is given unto me. I got a race. Any source will have him making one or more of these ridiculous claims. He talked of heaven from the inside. If I say I got a green couch in my living room, you ask me how I know, I'm going to look at you like you're a nut. You talk of your home with a familiarity. You don't say, I saw this or I saw that. He speaks, what do you think of me as your pastor if I came in here and said, before Abraham was, I was. I was up there, I saw Satan cast down, just thrown out with all of his angels. And I'm going to leave you now, but when I go, I'm going to prepare a mansion for you in heaven, then I'll come back and get you. He spoke of eternal things, expecting to believe that he had a first-hand knowledge. Good and wise teachers don't do that. Fourth, he put himself center of the universe, but particularly center of the religious universe. This is maybe the most characteristic distinction between Christ and the nonsense of liberal scientific thinkers that he left some kind of golden rule. Don't lay that golden rule on me. I don't want you doing to me what you want done to yourself, particularly if you're gay. You're all welcome in my church. It ain't my side of the street, what I'm saying. Just don't do to me what you want done to yourself. I like Confucius' golden rule. Don't do to me what you don't want done to yourself. I like that better. I'm safe there. Just don't do to me what you don't want done to yourself. And that way I can escape doing to me what you want done to yourself. None of those other founders put themselves center. He didn't teach a way apart from himself like Buddha. He didn't teach a logical pattern to do things. He didn't claim that there's only one God and he's his prophet like Muhammad. He put himself the center. Follow me. I'm the door. I'm the life. I'm the water. I'm the light. By me, if any man enter in, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. Everywhere he went, he didn't preach a way apart from himself. He condemned those who thought they had a perfect way. He made eternal life contingent upon accepting him and his claims and putting him. He that hateth not, Matthew puts in terms of preference, father, mother, wife, children, brother, sister, yea, and his own life also. Cannot be my disciple. I must be first. Now, if I tried that, you'd seek psychiatric care for me. Five, he said something wrong with the world that could only be set right by his death. Something wrong with all of you. And I alone can make it right by dying. He said his death was a ransom. He bought us in a context where the ransom was the price you paid to restore a lost inheritance or to save from death one that was thereby, because of his deeds, condemned. He elevated his death to the most prominent reason of his coming. For this cause I came. He rebuked his Satan, one of his closest disciples, that said, be it far from you. No, for this cause I came. His death was necessary to ransom the world from the clutches of something. And he said he would raise again with specificity. Third day. Even in the trial before the high priest, the accusation, there were two accusations. In the Jewish court, blasphemy. And we're talking about the Sanhedrin, the rulers. You know, I sort of admire them for the tenacity of their faith. They at least had the good sense to see that Jesus is making claims that are blasphemous. Blasphemous in their religious creed. The religious leaders. Most of the Jews of that day were as uninformed in their pure stream of religion. Probably today's Jews are a little more dedicated in reading and respecting the Torah. The common people, they didn't know all these ins and outs and sophistications, but the rabbis, the Pharisees and the Sadducees who debated with them, and certainly the Essenes with their extreme fundamentalism, analogous only to those today of the Hasidic Jewish group. There's as much diversity in Judaism as there is in Christianity. I mean, you know, you go to Passover, and read the newspaper, they always exploit those that are not very fundamentalist because it's the modern scientism way. So I hear all kinds of outlandish ideas of the Passover to teach us that we have troubles to be delivered from. The Passover was a deliverance from bondage. Bondage. A deliverance from slavery. With blood on the door and strength from the eaten lamb. And as you read of them going, if there had been a helicopter in those days, the Hebrew has it, that they went in groups of five. And as they went out of Egypt, which was always a type of bondage to sin, a helicopter taking a picture would see this millions of people going in groups of five, declaring to the heavens, by grace, the number of grace, by grace we've been delivered. They thought he was blaspheming. And before the high priest, art thou, you call yourself God, thou sayest. And when you see me again, I will be sitting in glory in the heavens and come again. They'd smite him and say, prophesy. And the judgment was rendered of blasphemy because, among other things, he made the ludicrous claim, this temple that took 46 years to build, which dates it, by the way, 46 years, 20 years from the beginning of Herod's temple, occurred before 1 B.C. So you can add up the following years. And if Jesus was born in 4 B.C., which he was, you then can figure out about the time. And if these were fraudulent transcriptions, they could have corrected that. They didn't need to put it in. He says, destroy this temple, which we took 46 years to build, and he'll raise it in 3 days. Not recognizing he was speaking in the same context as the one sign God will give is the sign of Jonah, 3 days in, 72 hours, and out with the resurrection. He made outrageous claims. And 8, he would be raised, seated in glory, and return again as the conquering Messiah. Any one of those claims makes you a nut or a fraud. Doesn't matter which. Nut or fraud. You could be wise and make those claims and be able to con your audience into believing it. But you can't be good. You could be nuts enough to believe it yourself and be honest, but not wise. I begin to see my professors never even looked at Jesus. They were just creating one of their own convenience. And something in this mind of mine had to settle it. So, what would make these claims true? If this one happened, he was raised on the third day and literally came out of that tomb, and the records are true that he raised from the dead, I would let any one of you, if you made these claims, I would think you were nuts or putting me on. But if you included the resurrection claim and 3 days later you came out of the grave, I'm taking another look at you. The resurrection became the passion of my life. Now, if you're going to discuss the resurrection with me, you're going to assume these facts. You don't have to assume them, but that's what I hate about most religious discussions. They're just fuzzy gibberish. You go into a courtroom, there's going to be certain established facts that, based upon those facts, you then construct the meat of your argument. If you want to make me prove these five facts, which I had to do for myself, or these six facts, or these seven facts, or these eight facts, they're much easier. It doesn't require any belief in the miraculous. It doesn't require, it's just simple historic analysis based upon the evidence. I mean, we've got pretty good attitudes about Alexander the Great. Plutarch's life of him, which is taken as standard, was written 400 years after he died. We're talking about records within 10, 20 years. 15 being the earliest, so I should say within 15 to 30 years of the events. And I remember everything my dad did, but I sure remember recent events. I can spend all day trying to prove Jesus lived. There's a bunch of books out on this subject now, not even the Jesus Seminar agrees he lives. Tacitus, the heathen historian, the Latin historian, recognizes he lives. Josephus, the Jewish historian, he lived. He was crucified. Not because the Passion movie says he was. He was crucified. Now listen closely. Hands of the Romans, instigation of not the Jews, Jewish leaders, religious leaders, the kind that are the most dangerous, because there's a halo around them. Jewish leaders accused him of blasphemy before the Sanhedrin, and then succored false witnesses to say that he had stirred up the kingdom and he was pronouncing himself king of the Jews. And this was rebellion against Caesar. That was the charge in Pilate and Herod's court. Crucified at the hands of the Romans, charged by Jewish leaders who honestly, there's no exception. You could only tear the robes of the high priest in the presence of blasphemy. And what Caiaphas asked him, have you claimed to be God? Thou sayest, I need hear no more, as he ripped his priestly robes apart, blasphemy. And the Jewish law required death for blasphemy. Read that Chandler book. But the Roman rulers had taken from the Jews' hands the right to execute, so they had to go to Pilate and get execution authorized by Pilate, the Roman procurator. The charge there was sedition and rebellion. Hands of Romans, Jewish leaders. Number three, considered dead. I'm not saying he was dead. Considered dead. Preached. Raised. Catch this. Ascended. And raised includes participating in normal activities. Food. Touch. Behold my wounds. Ascended. And empty tomb. The tomb's empty. They've taken my master. The Jewish leaders immediately accused the disciples of stealing the body to save face. Preached, raised, ascended, tomb empty. The Jewish leaders, not the Jews, most Jews didn't know about it. They were hearing about this from the disciples. Jewish leaders, more concerned to disprove than you and I could be 1900, almost 2,000 years removed. Common sense tells you that is deduction. If, and I'm saying, assume as a frame of reference, if you want to say after today that I preach long and boringly, or somebody's going to argue with it wasn't quite that bad, you're assuming I was here to preach. This is known as frame of reference. You can't discuss anything without taking certain other things for granted. How deep you want to dig, you start somewhere. Each of these facts are much easier to prove than the resurrection. This is a deduction. If Jewish leaders' charges of blasphemy for his claims brought about his crucifixion, they've got a bread and butter, pride and livelihood issue. They are made to be fools. They're made to be false chargers. They're made to be pretty sick-looking religious leaders. It's more important to them, even today, Everybody will fight harder for something they've said than for the same thing if they hadn't said it. Jewish leaders, obviously more concerned to disprove this preachment, which has certainly been done and is still being done. I'm doing it today. But in that day, they were more concerned to disprove it than you and I would be, which is why they instantly charged disciples stole the body. And they knew about the testimony of the resurrection. That was brought up in the temple saying, in the charges against him. So they persuaded Pilate, because some had said he had said he would raise, put a guard there and a rock sealing the tomb. And when he was preached raised, they were made to look like monkeys. So they persecuted the preachers who were preaching this. Well, I know that Nero later made the Christian scapegoats for the problems of the empire, but every record is consistent. The first preachers were abused and persecuted for preaching this outlandish basis of the faith. He rose. You hanged him on a tree, Peter says. God raised him up. You killed the Prince of Life. God raised him up. Accusations flying in the city of Jerusalem. Peter in prison for preaching that message. Persecuted. Persecuted. Again and again. And the tomb was empty. You know why I say that? If there had been a body in the tomb, the concern of these Jewish leaders to stop the preaching would have gone to the tomb and said, "Here, look, here's the body." These facts have to be assumed if you're going to talk with me about the resurrection, because if you're not going to assume these facts, then I'm going to take you to another issue. We won't be preaching on the resurrection. We'll be preaching on the Jewish leaders' concern. We won't be preaching on the resurrection. We'll be preaching on Jesus lived. We won't be preaching on whether or not he came out of that tomb and lived. Yeah, I knew I left a fact out. The tomb was empty because he was buried in a known, accessible tomb. Now, if the Jewish leaders instigated the charges, they were more concerned to silence the preaching, and the tomb was known, and they would have gone to the tomb and produced the body. Argue with me about these facts, I got a much easier job. But to talk about the tough job, the resurrection, these facts must be taken for granted. Now, because the preaching was with such prominence and fervor, and the cause of the rise of the Christian church, every kind of theory has been presented to explain these facts. One, disciples stole the body. Two, the Roman leaders, Romans, took it. Three, Jewish leaders took it. Four, they went to the wrong tomb in the darkness, early light. Five, hallucinations. Six, resuscitation. He was considered dead, but he, in the coolness of the tomb, revived. Seven, the whole thing's a lie. Eight, they told as honest people what they honestly experienced and what they believed to be true. Now, because the preaching was with such prominence and fervor, And the cause of the rise of the Christian church, every kind of theory has been presented to explain these facts. One, disciples stole the body. Two, the Roman leaders, Romans, took it. Three, Jewish leaders took it. Four, they went to the wrong tomb in the darkness, early light. Five, hallucinations. Six, resuscitation. He was considered dead, but he, in the coolness of the tomb, revived. Seven, the whole thing's a lie. Eight, they told as honest people what they honestly experienced and what they believed to be true. Now, honesty is not necessarily being accurate. Honesty has to do with the state of mind of the testifier. Does he honestly believe what he's telling? And within all of these is a later one, grave robbers, somebody stole the body. Now, I'm going to tell you, all eight of these, just like the startling alternate, the only Jesus of history is either good and not wise, or wise and not good. And you reveal your ignorance of the Jesus of the records that are available if you try to stamp on him, or don't go modifying it when you listen to me. Well, he may have been nutty. That's the preferred one rather than a con artist. And believe the impossible. But he did say some good things. That's not where you started. That's the modification, still avoiding the facts of looking at Jesus, the real Jesus of history, by escaping from the effort. You know, like one of my fellows who took his doctorate the same time I did at Stanford, went on to be president of Ball State, said, "Gene, I can argue with what you're saying, but I don't want to look at it because it forced me to change my whole life. And I'm too far along to risk that." He'd taken a greater risk, but I didn't argue with him. I at least respected him for being honest. I keep losing my handkerchief in my own hand. Don't go there. There's only two. Each one of these steps prove most people don't want to face the possibility of the supernatural. Their view is it can't happen, therefore it didn't happen. Therefore, anyone who says it did is just either gullible, simple-minded, or a continuation of a fraud. It can't happen, therefore it didn't happen, therefore anybody says it did happen isn't worth listening to, because it can't happen. That's arguing in a circle. You made up your mind before you started. The Christian position is it can't happen by anything we know. And it only happened to this person. Oh, there you cried in the early days of liberalism and wrote a book about the 16 crucified saviors of history. None of them came out of a tomb with evidence. This is to be looked at like any other historic event. I got an undergraduate major in history. Historic certainty is impossible. By definition, it means all logically conceivable evidence is there. And when you can no longer be an eyewitness, that logically possible evidence is gone. Historic certainty is always relative. Psychological certainty can only happen through exposure to the facts. I'm still agnostic. It's not true. It is true. Unbelievable, unshakable, irretrievable certainty. I haven't come to it yet. I'm walking around alive when I'm supposed to be dead because I hung my body on it. I'm more certain today than I ever was. I remember when I laid the last book down and says, "Okay, what next?" Faith is like glasses to a myopic man. If you're myopic, you got to have glasses. Maybe you can wear your granddad. Maybe you got to go see him ground. But at one point, faith puts them on. And if you bang into every door and stumble over every step, you're going to take them off and start over. But if you see clear, and the more you wear them, the more sure you become, you reach a state of amenness. And I'm closer to home and certainty than I've ever been. Each year I stream through the books to see if somebody, I see the Jesus Seminar people in these debates with Craig Lane, destroyed with their a priori presumptions that a Christ that's miraculous cannot be accepted in a world once you look through the telescope of Galileo. You look at the evidence. There's only two. Just like there's only the startling alternate. Jesus was either what he said he was, or he's another a fraud. All these are but theories to try to avoid looking at the facts. There's only two. They lied or told the truth. They didn't just preach. I don't want to even attack the plausibility. It's not plausible. Jews took it. They put it back. Facing this preaching, Romans took it. They have no power to go to him. Even a member of the Sanhedrin, Joseph of Arimathea, got the body and put it in a royal-type tomb. Doesn't make sense. Wrong tomb, go to the right one. Hallucinations, anybody with any psychological knowledge at all, there's a whole book there that breaks that apart. You've got to have a mental state of expectancy. It can't be something that's alien to your own nature. The Jews never believed in a resurrection until the last judgment came. None of these people expected a three-day resurrection. It's against everything in Jewish theology. Even those who believed in the resurrection, it's at the last judgment. You don't have hallucinations with above 500 people at once. You don't have diverse people, single individuals, having the same hallucinations. But go to the tomb. Go ahead and have your hallucinations. Here, take a walk with me. We're going to the known tomb. It's empty. And it's staggered probability that somebody steal the body. Same time the hallucinations are coming down. It is that tenacious side. I don't want to accept a miracle. I'll come up with any kind of thing. There's the whole book over there that blows the hallucination theory apart by a psychologist. Resuscitation? You don't resuscitate from a Roman crucifixion. I just read last night. Go ahead and check it out if you want to. JAMA. You ever hear of JAMA? Journal of the American Medical Association. From the Department of Pathology, Dr. Edwards and Medical Graphics, Mr. Hosmer, Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota. On the physical death of Jesus Christ, diagrammed, taken from all sources, Josephus, Tacitus, the Talmud, many references outside the Gospels. He died probably, I got a 90-yard word in here somewhere that I don't know about blood. Hematidrosis. You don't recover from a Roman crucifixion. And the appearances of Jesus were not a wasted, bloody mess. That beating that he got had round, solid instruments that impacted in. And either pieces of bone or other sharp instruments to tear the flesh even below the muscles. Resuscitation is not plausible. But it doesn't matter. Resuscitation has nothing to do with ascension. And resuscitation has nothing to do with the kind of resurrected Christ that they preached about. So they're lying. The story that they preach goes well beyond all the theories are just making the preachment an empty tomb. And then they dream up these imaginary ideas. The facts require accepting, preaching a resurrected, live and vital and healthy Christ, an ascending Christ. And that means that most of the story is still made up. It's a lie, and the choice boils down. Forced by the facts. You got to choose, just as you have to choose, is Jesus a madman or a fraud? You have to choose. It's the only Jesus you find in history. Is he either a madman or a fraud? You have to choose. Why not? The Jewish leaders did. They said he blasphemed. You have to choose. These reporters are making their story up. They bet on the wrong horse to save face. They're going to tell the story he raised. It took them 7 weeks to dream it up. And then they're preaching it. Okay. Why do I believe it's impossible that they were liars? They're rather honest reporters. One, cataclysmic change. Now, these Gospels were written in different places by different people within a few years of Christ's death and resurrection to support the preaching. Why do I believe they're not preaching a lie? A lie can change someone, but not uniformly for the better. These psychological personality types are woven through these independent studies. Peter's always an impetuous, in trouble with himself. He's going too far or drawn back too far. It's Peter that sasses Jesus when he talks of his death. It's Peter who goes to sleep. You love him, but he goes to sleep on the Mount of Transfiguration. And you don't get this in just one story. It's woven through all four of them. He goes to sleep. Jesus took three of them up there because he had to prepare himself for the Passion Week, and the rest of the Gospels is that final week. He goes to sleep. God had to send two old tigers of the Old Testament that, if you believe the Old Testament, didn't die a natural death. Moses' body was fought over between Michael and the devil. Elijah was caught up with Elisha beholding it in a chariot and disappeared in the sky. We won't believe that. That's Old Testament. I'm talking about the New Testament miracle. But in the Transfiguration record, God sends these two old tigers, Moses and Elijah, who had fought in faith. And when Peter woke up, he hears them talking about Christ's decease. In other words, Jesus took them up, his helpers, to get encouragement. Imagine that. And they went to sleep, so God sent Elijah and Moses to encourage him. They talked of his decease. And when you read after that, he goes down the hill and straightway set his face to go to Jerusalem, knowing he must die. He was up there to get strength. Peter slept. Peter wakes up. Oh! Let's build three temples here, because three tabernacles here. One for Moses, one for Elijah, one for Jesus. Take charge. Impetuous. Elevating Moses and Elijah to Jesus. Oh, I want to wash your feet. You ain't washing my feet, Jesus. Well, if I can't wash your feet, you're not going to be in my kingdom. Wash me all over. There were the extremists. Wait and watch with me while he prayed in the garden to get ready for the event of his crucifixion. And by the way, you get your word excruciating from the Latin word, which means from the cross. He went through the excruciating pain of the garden as he agonized to see if God would let him not make the trip. The Lord's Prayer, again. Nevertheless, not as I will, but thine. Goes back and Peter's sleeping, the rest of the disciples. Couldn't you watch with me 1 hour? Soldiers come. Peter wakes up half asleep, giving courage, draws a sword, cuts off the high priest's servant's ear. Jesus says to him, just quit it, Peter, and heals the ear. Quit it. I could call legions of angels to fight for me. You can't even hit the target. He didn't say that. I added that. One of you is going to betray me tonight. Not me. If they slay me, I won't betray you. Before the cock crows, he betrays him three times. A consistent personality trait. Jesus sends him a special message after the resurrection. Wait in Galilee, I'm coming. Jesus is late. Peter says, I go fishing. Suddenly after the resurrection, he becomes the rock that Jesus had prophesied. Never wavering, standing in front of a mocking mob on the street, accusing them, you killed the Prince of Life, but God raised him up. Change from impetuosity and instability to stability and faith. That's for the better. John, he and his brother are called sons of thunder. They call fire from heaven, they say, they want it to happen, on those who oppose them. They want the best seat in the kingdom. And lowlifes send their mother to ask for it. Everybody agrees after this event, John becomes the apostle of love beyond all other disciples. A radical change. And this is woven through four different separately written stories. And by the way, the one that makes Peter look the worst is Mark. And Peter was the source, eyewitness source, of all the events as the tutor of Mark. And all agree with that. Thomas, consistently a doubter. When Jesus is going to go through Samaria, Thomas says, let us also go that we may die with him, giving credit for courage. But that's a humanistic view of his master. He thought he would actually be killed by human hands when Jesus had said repeatedly, no man taketh my life from me. The shepherd lays his life down for the sheep. Again, Jesus is talking about going away and preparing mansions. He says, I'm going to leave you. Speaking of his departure, his death and his return to heaven. I'm going to leave you. I'm going to go away and I'm going to prepare mansions. And then I'm going to come back and get you and take you to be with me. And whither I go, you know, and the way, you know. Now, I can see those other disciples like what I see on a lot of religious television. Just the minute he said the word mansions, it was like setting something off. I'm going to prepare a mansion for you. Hoop-de-doo-da-da-da-da. They don't listen to anything else. Now, Thomas, the skeptic, he's listening to every word. And Jesus comes to that point, whither I go, you know, and the way, you know. He butts in and says, we don't know the way. We don't know where you're going, and we don't know the way. Typical. I always had an affection for Thomas. But I think like he thinks. Questioning too much. Who's doubting when the resurrection story comes? Same Thomas. Again, woven through multiple Gospels. I will not believe it till I put my hand in the very print of the crucifixion. So much for hallucinations. And Jesus appeared, and I always took comfort in this. He said, an axiomatic truth is better to believe without seeing, because you have simple faith. You don't have all the agony of your mind. But behold, my hands and my side. He offered to submit to the very test that Thomas asked for. And Thomas fell on his knees and cried, my Lord and my God. I recently, it'll be in the exhibits, came upon a very rare study of the Thomas Christians on the coast of India. Thomas went on to Madras to be pierced with a Brahmin sword. But he founded the St. Thomas Christians on the coast of India. And they have some of the most priceless and prized and ancient Syriac manuscripts in Estrangula, the classic script of the Syriac, because they cherish them. It's in the hands of individual clerics. They give their life to protect them. They are not very many of them in museums for that reason. Of the St. Thomas Christians. He never wavered from that moment, piercing the area, the Vedanta faith, the spring from which Buddhism grew, the Hindu, mentally focused philosophic religions. He pierced that and planted the Christian faith. And the Syriac Nestorian language penetrated into that area as a result of these Galileans, all of whom spoke Syriac. Changed from doubt to faith. His brother, James. The Catholics believe not Jesus' brother, either son of Joseph by previous marriage or cousin from another Mary. The Eastern Orthodox people believe, the Catholics have to believe that since Jerome, because they're peddling the ridiculous concept of the perpetual virginity of Mary. A child coming out does quite damage to the hymen, if I may be blunt. But that's supposed to be believed, not with evidence, just because they say it. So all kinds of arguments about James, the brother of the Lord. Nobody says she was a virgin after the birth of Christ. The scriptures are very clear. He didn't know her until after the birth of Christ. And know her means consummation, copulation. The ossuary has stirred the news across the country, and everybody except clear experts in the area of language, strata, have come out on it. Some public relations guy said, you can't possibly discuss this subject without using this person who didn't know anything. There's a book over here, The Ossuary of James, dating clear back to the first century. You ought to try to get it and read it. The brother of Jesus. Dramatic story and meaning of the first archaeological link to Jesus and his family. James was his brother. Half-brother. Born of Joseph and Mary. Half-brother. That's the Protestant position, different from the Eastern Orthodox and the Catholic, who will not accept that. They've got to deal with this ossuary. Half-brother. God, through the Holy Spirit in a miracle, brought forth this Spirit-conceived God-man. A deduction, W. Gresham Machen, has never been answered in his arguments of the virgin birth. If you accept the resurrection, you accept the fact that God moved from the eternities, struck a tent in human flesh to fulfill the Jewish law of kinsman-redeemer. He must be kin to us, and he kin with us, took on the form of sinning flesh, yet knew no sin, fulfilled the law to bring forth the price of redemption, and had to make it voluntarily, and did make it, and is raised now. Take your theological, philosophic, platonic concepts and just shove them in a garbage can. There is that which had never been seen on history stage since God made Adam in his image, God in man with a measure of the Spirit to conquer the flesh, and now there is in the eternities, sitting there as the Hilasterion, what has never existed there before, an immortalized God-man. That's the doctrine of the resurrection. He went up there as the first fruits of what we shall be. James. All his family at Nazareth were going to seize him because they thought he was nuts with the claims he was making. His family rejected him, and he them, saying, who is my mother? Who are my brethren? These that do the will of my Father that sent me. Not until the resurrection. Specifically named as a witness in 1 Corinthians 15, James, the brother of our Lord. Why, he had a problem and had to be contested with by Paul. He was a devout, probably a member of the Essenes, a devout Jew who thought his brother was nuts until he confronted him at the resurrection. And because of the Middle Eastern belief that a blood relative must rule in the absence of the founder, which produced the Shiites, in contrast to the Sunnis of the Muslims, who went with the one that had the spiritual leadership. The Shiites went with the bloodline. James was put in charge of the church of Jerusalem. And all he did was add a belief that Jesus was Messiah. You still had to keep the law. And the fight occurred at the First Council. You all know that history. He pastored 19 years in Jerusalem. A change. Total. A brother. The hardest people to convince. Changed to a believer. And still a devout. Pharisaical practicing Jew believing Christ is the Messiah. Keeper of the law. They say he prayed so much in the temple he had knees like camels. It's not a pattern of a liar. What about Paul? I left him out of many of the previous messages. Paul, he's taken paper. He held the coat of those who stoned Stephen. He had papers to put under arrest Christians worshiping in the synagogues at Damascus. Cataclysmically changed until the rest of his life. Beatings, torture. He can end, I've kept the faith. They all changed for the better. From a murderer, an imprisoner of those that disagreed with his faith, to an apostle of love, he wrote 1 Corinthians 13. These are cataclysmic changes. I hope I'm not boring you, but I'm going to finish this. Number two, there's intrinsic, inside evidences of truthful reporters. Contrary to their own interest, they paint bad pictures of themselves. That counts in the court of law when you're evaluating the credibility of the witness. You are making statements that hurt your cause. Mark writes to Gentiles, to a Jew that read the book of Enoch, which was prominent in that day, and Daniel, son of man, means you're the Messiah coming in clouds of glory. Everybody agrees Mark wrote either to the Gentiles at Alexandria in Egypt or to the Romans. They never read the book of Enoch. They don't know anything about son of man messiology. Yet, writing to try to prove that Jesus is Son of God, he has Jesus referring to himself in the shortest gospel, more than any other gospel, as Son of Man. Contrary to his objective, he's being true to the story. Little things suggest honest reporters. He has the disciples before the 5,000 miracle. Where do we buy bread? One passage has, he has the disciples. Another says he has Philip. Separate, written in separate places. Why do you ask Philip? You go to another gospel, John. Philip was from Bethsaida. And the place that he asked the question is near Bethsaida. So the logical one to ask where to buy bread, Philip. You have to read at least two gospels to find that out. When the throng presses at Lake Gennesaret, one of the Gospels says he stepped into, and you've heard me enough to know that the definite article is very important in the Greek. He stepped into the boat. The throng pressed and he stepped into the boat. You have to go to another Gospel written in a different place to find that before the throng pressed in, he instructed his disciples to secure a small boat. So now the other one is saying he stepped into the boat. Little intrinsic evidences of truth. Why would they, if they're making up a lie, have women as the first witnesses when women were not allowed to testify because they were not considered a truthful witness or an adequate witness? They're telling the truth. Little things like John ran ahead of Peter and got to the tomb first, waiting. John was younger. Peter was older. I could go for hours on these little intrinsic evidences of truthful reporting. Let's just take one more. Each of the Gospels tell of this trial before the high priest. One of them says, they smote him on the face and said, prophesy. That's all. Another one says, they smote him on the face and said, prophesy, thou Messiah. You have to go to a third one to read. They first blindfolded him and then smote him on the face and said, prophesy, tell us who hit you. That's why cops separate the witnesses. But out of the different piecemeal, you're going to get the common thread of truth. These people, if they were conniving and a generation later somebody's making up a lie, they would protect themselves against such things as having Jesus refer to himself as Son of Man, which presupposes a knowledge of Old Testament Scripture. Again and again, intrinsic evidences. Number three, I could go on with 100 of these. Oh, let me try one. One more. They pierced him. Out came blood and water. They weren't yet sophisticated enough to know about the separation of blood. To them, just blood and water came out. Why not just say blood? They told the truth. The price they paid. Bartholomew was skinned alive with a whip, the persecution for the message. Played to death with a whip in Armenia. Andrew crucified on St. Andrew's cross. Peter crucified upside down. Thomas pierced with a sword near Magus. Luke hanged by idolatrous priests in Greece. Mark dragged to death in the streets of Alexandria. You know the record of Paul. Of the Jews, 5 times received thy 40 stripes, save one, thrice beaten with rods, stoned, a day and a night in the deep, on with the record of his persecution. All of them save John. A horrible martyr's death. Now this is St. Thomas Aquinas. Great proof. Number one, you don't pay that kind of price for a lie. Particularly if you're dying alone. I could believe that we might concoct a story. Carl, you want to be Peter over in Rome? Mr. Brack? Sam, you want to be Thomas in India? And I'll be Bartholomew in Armenia. No TV. There's no wire service. There's no telegrams. There's no CNN. I don't even know if I write you a letter, I can get it to you. And we may never see each other again. But a few years ago, we concocted this story. We bet on this wrong horse. And he died a cursed criminal. To save face, we concocted the story. I can believe that three of us are together. Either one of us wants to be the one to let the others down and break faith. We've got to support the story. Scatter us. I'm alone in Armenia. You don't even know where I am, neither do you. They're beating me to death, flaying me to death with a whip, and all I got to say is, whoa! Lord Caesar! I'm a liar, what do I care? We made it up. Stories, wonderful. Storytellers are abound. And I get off the flogging, and I meet you later. I say, time. Man, they tried to get me to renounce the story, but man, I stuck to it. I didn't break faith. And Mr. Brack, I want you to know, I didn't let us down. How are you going to know? Since I'm a liar, the issue is liar or honest. I don't expect this to be some divine canonized story. We just saved face. I'm over here in Armenia and my skin's coming off. Hey! Catch the next boat out and tell you how I stuck to the story. Same goes to you in your place and you in your place. Psychologically inconceivable. 1900 plus years, you find the slightest evidence anywhere that any one of these storytellers ever reneged on their story. Dying alone for a lie. Inconceivable. I remember my professor Larry Thomas saying to me, when I finished to this point, Gene, I agree. They believed their story. They were telling what they believed to be true. So therefore, someone of your other eight facts must be wrong. I smiled at him and said, I got you, sir. This experimentalist, the major spokesman of John Dewey on the West Coast, progressive education experimentalism, who wept in the closing social philosophy class as he described the ontology of experimentalism and our only being is like a wave in the sea, subsequently became a Catholic before his death. I want to believe, and I'll ask him up there, did that knowing statement, I got you, make you look at the facts and come to the conclusion that made me lay the last book down and say there isn't any other explanation? He came out of that grave. If that's true, I don't need any other definition of God. He is the center of the religious universe. He is the source of authority. It was his use of the Old Testament that made me drench myself in it. He did ransom me. He did pay the price for my sins. He is alive today as my helasterion. And as I trust in God's promise, I no longer have to be perfect. He puts the perfecter in me as I keep the connection of trust and faith. My helasterion brings me joy, and that's my message today.